welcome to the Devious Maids Recap Podcast featuring John Frusciante and Will Hines.
Oh, we got some good ones today. Yeah. Man, I've already updated the Wikipedia pages.
Have
so
you?
All the information's at my fingertips.
You're the chief updater of the Devious Maids television show Wikipedia page.
That's right. Oh, man, and we got behind-the-scenes gossip, we got fan fiction.
You know, after last week, and I said this on the podcast last week, I don't think the maids could get any more devious, but this week they really did.
They really did. I'm also assuming at this point that Devious Maids is a show?
Yes.
Okay.
we're back, Will.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. How was your lecture tour?
It wasn't bad.
No?
It wasn't bad.
That sounds like it was a disappointment
to you.
Well,
it was one stop at Wheaton College, then I was trapped in a burrow.
Oh,
they kidnapped me into a burrow, and they made me do heralds. Apparently, their generators run on heralds.
Okay.
So I was like a one-man herald powering Wheaton College
wow.
for a long time.
That is a weird engineering choice.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
At first, I was upset, but then I just kind of weirdly fell into it.
To run your entire college on an obscure art form?
How organic your connections are.
That's what runs
As soon as I forced anything, there was brownouts all over the campus.
Wow. Jesus.
Yeah. Made me better. You know what? I welcome it. It was a good lesson.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Two big bits early in the show.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, we got to make up for it. We got a big backlog of bits.
Charlie Todd's listening to this like, just get to the guest.
Did you hear my alliteration there? I said big backlog of bits. That was good, right?
Yeah. Your dream of being in a 90s band is someday going to be true.
Speaking of 90s bands, our guest this week is Josh Patton.
Yeah. Hi, guys.
Hi, Josh.
Hi, you really salted the earth with bits to start off this podcast.
Boy, you better be just full of conceit.
I'm really nervous that I won't be able to match.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you'll catch up. We set a high bar here.
Yeah.
High bit bar.
Yeah, speaking of high bits, why did you, what that segue?
Yeah.
Speaking of 90s bands.
I have no idea.
I'm not a part of any 90s band.
Aren't you behind Counting Crows?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Counting Crows
Twitter?
I do
That's what I thought
Twitter
he was doing.
Account. Okay.
But also you're in Counting
and also,
Crows.
And didn't you Matchbox 20 Weather or whatever like that?
Rob Thomas Weather.
That's why. Yeah, There's two big reasons.
Me and Drew Johnston have a couple of parody accounts that we run. We stopped doing Rob Thomas Weather once we got to a hot one. Man, it's a hot one. All right. I'll back up. So it's a Rob Thomas Weather Twitter account. And what it did is every day.
Rob Thomas, the lead singer, Matchbox 20.
Right. But as a solo artist, along with Santana, he did a song called Smooth, and it starts off, man, it's a hot one. Mm-hmm. So every day, Drew Johnston and I would tweet out what the weather was. Man, it's a cloudy one. Man, it's a stormy one. Man, it's a moist one. You know, and we did that for about, God, 8 months.
And then, that's a long
time. Yeah, it's a long time. We started in September. So we couldn't get Man, It's a Hot One, the one from the song, until like it was actually hot 8 months later.
Mm-hmm.
And then we did, and we tweeted out the whole lyrics. And somebody wrote a news article.
Yeah, it was in like the Post
like
or something.
You wrote the whole lyrics.
Yeah.
As if that was all just pre-sung.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. It's like he's just searching for the right inspiration, and he gets to Man, It's a Hot One, and then the song just And that's a sister account to Counting Crows _. It's Counting Crows, and then there's an _. Or if you want to get into the phenomenon ground floor.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
And that just tweets out how many crows.
One crows, two crows, three crows. We lost count one time. Had to start over. So that was and then we found a murder of crows one time, so we jumped ahead.
Mm-hmm.
One time we found a carcass of a crow, and that was so it was like 148 and a half crows.
Mm-hmm.
So those three jokes are the only three jokes we've done in a year. We have a fourth joke planned. It's going to be pretty sure. It's coming up in a couple months.
Couple months.
Yeah, it's a slow burn. It's a slow burn.
So far away.
Yeah.
I don't even know what I'm doing with my life in a couple of months.
Yeah.
Well, it's because we have to just count crows normally. It can't all be bits because like the Twitter account is to count crows. And if we don't count crows, what the fuck's the point, guys?
That's true.
We could jump right into an improv discussion.
It's like being devious maids, but all you do is have sex and you don't do any maid work.
Right. Yeah, so
that is
you're
a
not
show?
Playing the situation.
It's a show, yeah, it's a show. It's a show. Mm-hmm. They're maids, but they're, you know, they're backstabby.
It's like Desperate
salacious.
Housewives, but with more boobs or
it's
something like
same,
that?
It's the same producer as I think Desperate it, Housewives, I
yeah,
think.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But I mean...
Some hot Latin chicks, Will. Yeah. Check it out.
It was on Desperate Housewives, too.
There was one.
Yeah.
This I mean, is like five.
Multiple?
Yeah.
I mean, well, if you want to confuse desperation with deviousness, that's, you know...
I do.
Okay.
I forgot to mention that our podcast intern is here, Sypha Sounds.
Hey.
Sypha Sounds.
Are we doing season two? Or
I guess we could call this season two to justify the break. I like to. I don't like this 1A stuff.
Yeah.
I've never liked that when Battlestar
did
that. Yeah. Let's just
calling this season two will then clear any of the vacuum of podcasts the last couple months. Just say,
yeah.
It lets us off the hook.
Like, yeah. We left you on a cliffhanger.
That's a great justification.
Who was the last guest? Brandon Gardner.
Oh, and it was a good one, right?
Yeah, that's a good season finale.
Yeah.
Season two, guys.
Mm-hmm. All right, season two. Thank you, Cypher.
And another cliffhanger from the end of season one was, will podcast intern Keaton Patty be back? Was he killed when he drove off the edge of that cliff?
Yes.
Or did he miraculously survive? Turns out he miraculously survived.
Hi, Keaton.
I survived, guys.
Yeah. That's what his voice sounds like.
Yep. Yeah, yeah. Wow, terminally that's off mic. New season. We decided to hand Keaton the mic every now and again.
It's like seeing Colonel Potter's wife. 70s TV show, MASH.
Right.
You never saw his wife.
Close.
Yeah, just as, it might as well be.
Keaton didn't have a microphone on him when he started talking right there, so I don't know if we picked up on it on that. But he got one chance to talk into a microphone.
That my MASH reference
just
was
goes off with it.
Yeah.
Josh, you are a veteran improviser here. You taught for a little while.
Uh huh. Right? I still do. I taught a couple intensives this summer.
Right. Yeah. That's right. Sorry. And now you are you've been a writer on SNL.
Yep.
For how long?
I'm going into my second year this season.
That's great.
So season 39 of the show.
Fantastic.
So I was there for season 38 and season 39. Mm-hmm. So yeah, got hired last year, and I write for Weekend Update with Seth Meyers, and I write jokes for him, which is super fun and great, and that's what I'm doing again this year.
Mm-hmm. So why don't we just do a quick kind of improv or comedy bio. How did you get here? How did you get your start?
Oh, sure. I started doing improv in Washington, D.C. In 2005. So I was 25 years old when I found it. So like a little bit older than I think a lot of people are. Because a lot of people have college improv troupes and stuff. Mm-hmm. I never had it. I had zero exposure to comedy or improv like as a thing that people do.
Okay.
And I was living in D.C. working in politics. And a friend mentioned like, oh, hey, you're funny. You should do this Washington Improv Theater. Which is, it's like the long form improv theater in DC, right. much smaller in scale than UCB. But they, it's still same thing. You know, they teach like level 1, 2, 3, and 4 and Herald classes, and they have shows and everything like that. So I started doing it there. And as soon as I did it, I was like, well, this is what I should be doing. This is the best thing in the world. I should tailor my life so I can do this at the most possible amount of time I can. Mm-hmm. So while I was in DC, I, you know, took a couple classes, got put on a house team there, and then started teaching there. My first class I ever taught was actually with Natasha Rothwell.
Okay.
I TA'd Natasha's level 2 class in DC because Natasha Rothwell is on the curfew.
Mm-hmm. Right.
UCB is from DC as well. So I taught a little bit there, got put on a team, and then I was like, well, I need to move to a place where I can do this more than one or two nights a week, because that's sort of the max out that you can do in D.C. in improv. So I moved up to New York because I thought about moving to Chicago, L.A., or New York, and decided New York because I had an apartment to live at.
Ah,
yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Smart, and then, practical decision.
And then that would have been August of 2007 that I moved up to New York, and got into the city at 11. I'd never been to New York in my life. Got into the city at 11:30 at night on a Sunday and started a intensive 101 class Monday morning at 10 a.m.
Hmm.
So
wow.
I like sort of moved in and immediately got to it. And then my 201 started. We had a class show on Sunday for an intensives, and then my 201 started Sunday night after my class show.
Wow.
So less than I'd been in New York less than a week and had already started a 201 class.
Did you?
And then I calmed the fuck down.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Yeah. If you intentionally, it was like, I want to end this 101 intensive and go right to a 201 intensive.
Yeah, because it was open. Because I mean, okay. This is back in 2007, so it wasn't like the madness now where classes sell out in a mm-hmm. hot second. Mm-hmm. But it was like classes kept selling out, and then like, oh, well, this one became available. I can make it work, so I'll do it. Might as mm-hmm. well just do it sooner rather than later. Mm-hmm. Without knowing like what the structure of the theater was or the classes program or anything like that. I was like, well, I'll take this one and I'll take the next one. That'll be great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was there anything in particular that stuck out to you or struck you about once you started taking classes here? Like you had that feeling in Washington right away of like, this is what I need mm-hmm. to do for the rest of my life. Did you have any kind of similar feeling when you took classes here, or was it just more of same?
Not in 101, because I think for 101, if you've done improv before, it covers a lot of that ground. If like mm-hmm. if, you know, I've been doing improv for 2 years, so like I've kind of had the 101 experience through that. But with 201, I think I had that moment that you're talking about in 201, basically with the introduction when we start talking about game, mm-hmm. I think was sort of a click moment to me because that one of the things I love about UCB, particularly UCB, as opposed to, you know, some improv experiences I haven't had, is that idea of, I think it's just an honest assessment of like, yeah, we're here to be funny. You know, we want to do that. Mm-hmm. Game helps us do that. There's a standard and there's a bar which we can achieve, as opposed to like sort of a loosey-goosey, well, if you're out there, just connect and you'll be okay. Like, that stuff doesn't speak to me as much as like, no, we think we can be funny with this. Here's mm-hmm. how we think we can do it. So let's put this into practice. It's sort of that level of accountability, I think, takes it from hobby to an art.
Mm-hmm. I think. That kind of process.
Yeah, yeah. I don't – yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And so, do you remember any, was there anybody in that class, in those classes that's still around?
101 and 201, geez. The only person from my 101 that's still around is Julia Wiedemann.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Who did Naked People?
Yes.
Naked?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Naked.
And she hosts Storytelling Open Mic at
right.
UCB East.
So Julia was in my 101. In my 201, I honestly can't remember. Mm-hmm. 301 is where I sort of started meeting people, and I imagine that story is like that. No matter when you are, I think that that is sort of universally true, right? Where 301 is sort of where you meet those practice group type people and people you get on indie teams with, and that's I've met everybody in 301.
Yeah, if you make it that far, you're really starting to get like, all right, I'm serious. I'm going to do this. I'm going to start practicing. I really want to get better.
Yep.
And so, all right. So who's your first? Who's the first team that you were on? Who's the first Herald?
First Herald team
was
the Bishop. I got put on when Christine Nangle got hired by Saturday Night Live. This would have been in September of 2009. Mm-hmm. So I got put on that team, and I was on that team for, I think, 3 or 4 months. This is back when there were 10 Herald teams.
Yeah.
You guys remember that?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Too many Herald teams, basically. So we were on – I guess I was on for like 3 or 4 months, which would have been the equivalent of like maybe 6 or 7 shows.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then that team got cut, and there was sort of a month of purgatory where I thought I was like, well, all right. Well, that was fun. I'm done. because we got cut before, like a month before the auditions.
Mm-hmm.
And then after the next round of auditions, I didn't audition. I signed up to audition and then emailed Anthony King like the day before the auditions, like, hey, I heard I might not have to do this. And he was like, yeah, all you Bishop people don't have to do it. Like everybody on Bishop at Penthouse, right? Like you can't like show me anything, you know?
Yeah.
The two teams that got cut when
right.
they were 10.
Yeah.
So I emailed him like, the day before the audition, because like people on the Bishop were like, CC Lederer, I think, and Will Story were like, yeah, we're going to audition. Like, what time do you have? We were like emailing each other about it. And then somebody decided to like email Anthony and got the word that like we didn't have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, all right, well, fuck, I guess I'm really done. and then during that round of auditions, I got put on Ragnarok, which was a team I was on for a year and a half, maybe?
Yeah.
Yeah. Longer time for that team. Yeah. And then got moved to Grandma's Ashes.
Right.
Those are the three Herald teams I was on. And I'm still on Grandma's Ashes because we got moved to the weekend.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So what was that experience like being on the Bishop, getting put on there? Like, what do you remember from that?
It was tough. It psychs you out. Like, I don't think I was mentally prepared for it. I thought I had done well in classes.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I had, like, I felt that I had a decent rudimentary mastery of improv and game and like Heralds, and like I knew the pieces, I knew where they went, thought I was good in classes, but then when I got on to the Bishop, it was like we weren't the best team. Like, it was all great, wonderful, successful, awesome people, but we just didn't click for whatever reason, and I came in as like the 8th person into that team, and I was like, fuck, why this is bad because of me, this is all me. And so I let like those psychological pressures like sort of get to me a little bit, and maybe didn't do my best work, but at the same time I can't remember what work I did, so it may have been just fine and serviceable. But I definitely had a feeling in my mind of like, oh hey, cool, I really wanted this for a while and I got it and I'm sucking at it.
Yeah.
Which was like, that was tough.
I think that's
I was
a
not
feeling.
Very happy.
Yeah
And then like 3 or 4 months later we got broken up, so I was like, well, that chance is gone. So I just had to sort of come to peace with that.
Yeah, I think what you're talking about is fairly common. I think it happens to people that, like, you go through the classes and you get to that point. You're like, yeah, I got this. I know what I'm doing. I'm confident. I'm killing it in my classes. And then you get put on a team and suddenly something changes.
Yeah, I think I was a little bit caught up in what I should be doing rather than what I could be doing, which is a big distinction. Whenever I'm in dark improv times or dark comedy times, like, that distinction really helps me out.
Mm-hmm.
Normally if I'm doing what I think I should be doing, it's not fun. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel right to me. whether it's writing or improvising or teaching or whatever. If I feel like, oh, hey, we can do this. Like, right. what are the goals, and like find the best way to get there. Like, I think that serves me better.
So is that how you get, like, how do you make that shift when you get into those dark comedy times?
I get kicked off a Herald team and then put back a month later. I don't know. It's basically just like self-reflection. I think I am good about honestly assessing myself and mm-hmm. where I'm at and what's going on mentally. And when that happens, I do my best, and like, I still get stuck in should, mm-hmm. you know, with Grandma's Ashy shows now. Mm-hmm. This past year was a little bit weird in that regard, where I would find myself getting stuck in like, oh, I should be doing this, as opposed to just getting out there and having fun and doing what I can do mm-hmm. with a backbone of like that skeleton of skills and stuff.
Yeah. What changes when you tell yourself, oh, let's forget what I should do? What do you find yourself doing differently? You're on the back line, right?
I stop gauging the reaction to the move.
Uh huh.
The crowd reaction or the
crowd
reaction?
And teammate reaction, because basically I can get down into. I'm very, as an improviser, I think that I've always been a little bit more on the writerly. Directorial side of like, mm-hmm. oh, well, this here should be the second move of this. Here's a good place for this second beat. Here's mm-hmm. a good show-wide sort of structure that we can wrap it around, which is like mm-hmm. sort of like writing room type skills. Or even in pattern games, like the guy who I'm very good at being the person who pegs down the funny idea, like sort of synthesizes two things. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like sort of a writer's room sort of pitch type session. But I think that the peril of that for me personally
like is, you'd be in a pattern game to something like taglines for diseases or something like that. You would like give a label to what was being pitched around or something like that.
What were the things that led up to taglines for diseases? Like AIDS, catch it.
So would yeah.
Right. Like, okay, cool. So AIDS.
Yeah. Like diabetes. I'm loving it.
Yeah. Cool. Taglines for diseases. Cool. Yeah. Positive marketing for awful things.
Yeah.
Right. It depending on like how broad or narrow. Like yeah. I think the idea necessitates. Yeah. Like so that basically that kind of pattern game. Mm-hmm. I did that a lot. But the peril of that is that sometimes like when I'm on the back line or in a scene and I like have like a spark of a move, what I can do is say like, oh well, if this happens, then move two would be this and move three would be this, and the audience's reaction would be this and somebody else's reaction would be this, and like basically starting to calculate like a bunch of if then what else processes in mm-hmm. my head, and that's when I think I'm like and should when I think
that's
what
bad.
Yeah.
But it's what you're good at.
But in the moment, but if I do that, that causes me to hesitate.
I see.
And applying those skills. Like having that kind of thought process in a scene or in a show is fine, but applying that to like, okay, well, how's the audience reacting to it and how are my teammates reacting to it is detrimental.
Right, yeah. Right. Because, and basically like that moment, that moment of hesitation is a little bit, can be fatal sometimes. Mm-hmm. And B, just like that lack of trust that the first move, the like, if this, then the then's going to be okay. Mm-hmm. So, and a lot of that's just self trust and self confidence, I think.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think that if there's a mental thing that's going on in my mind during those moments, I think that's it. That might be a shitty answer.
No, I like it. Yeah, I like that stuff.
It's interesting how, like, you know, even when we get to a point where it doesn't really necessarily matter, like being on a weekend team, like you're not going to get cut.
Right,
grandma's
right.
ashes, you know.
Right.
But it's still just like I mean, I have the same thing, and you know, Will, you might have the same thing too, where you go through these periods of like, fuck, I'm not doing it right.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I live there.
Yeah. oh yeah, I mean, like I'm racked with self doubt about. I've constant feelings of being a fraud. I've permeated my comedy career, which I think is like normal. Mm-hmm. You know,
they will find out about you someday.
What? Yeah, I know that I'm not as funny as I.
You can only run for so long.
yeah, that's true. God, those demons are going to catch me one day.
When did you start to make that? You talked about having like a kind of writerly kind of brain and approach. Like, when did you start to think about taking writing seriously?
Oh, when Twitter became a thing. I started doing Twitter. I can't remember when. 2009, 2010, or something like that. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But it was like sort of as it was getting a big thing, but also it had been an established thing, so there were funny people on Twitter. Mm-hmm. And like my you guys had Jubin Parang on here, and he talked about like that competitive aspect of comedy, mm-hmm. Which is a streak that I definitely have myself. And I think that I looked at Twitter and was like, oh, fuck, these people with all these followers and all these, like, I can write funnier jokes than they can. And so just, like, started doing it. And it's, like, a little bit arrogant and egotistical, but also racked with, like, that same self-doubt. Mm-hmm. But, like, in the moment of creation, I think we have to be arrogant pricks.
Right.
Then afterwards, we can rack our brains and think about every single thing we did wrong.
What's your personal code for a good tweet for you? What are you trying to do when you write one? Like, all jokes, right? No personal stuff?
I mean, everything's funny. I'll do funny personal things. Like,
but you would never write just, like...
having lunch.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't. It has to be interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Like, so, like, what that does is that takes out a lot of, like, cliched joke formulas.
Mm-hmm.
That takes out a lot of, like, comedic takes that I've already heard that I just put my own spin on.
Would you ever do a, I like my coffee like I... like
I did one coffee tweet.
Yeah. I feel like everybody on Twitter does, I like my coffee like I like my men.
Mine was I like my coffee like I like my jazz. Karl Malone.
Yeah.
Just that.
Yeah.
It's nonsense.
Yeah.
But the point was, like, to be nonsensical. So I was like, oh, well, that's new. That seems interesting to me. It's not like, you know, to find out some homonyms that apply to coffee and the opposite sex. Like,
I think you actually tweeted once, like, what are we going to do once all the homonyms have been used?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. That the end goal of Twitter is to identify all of the English language's homonyms, which I think sometimes. But whatever, I'll do a good homonym joke every now and again.
May I ask you a series of really, like, micromanaging Twitter, or, like, way too thinking about it too much Twitter questions?
Sure.
What's your favoriting policy?
Favoriting policy?
How strict are you with that favorite? Loosey-goosey?
I'm pretty.
Do you dole it out like a miser?
I'm pretty loosey goosey. I think do I dole it out like who?
Are you miserly or generous?
Oh, miser.
Do you throw that shit around, like, or are you Scrooge pre or post ghosts in your favoriting of tweets?
I'm Scrooge, like, right when he was realizing it was Christmas Day. Because, like, sometimes I'll be on Twitter and I'll scroll through and laugh at stuff and say, like, okay, that's funny, but not, like, bother to hit the button.
Uh-huh.
But, like, sometimes I'll go on splurges and just throw them around. I'm probably, for a person who uses Twitter a lot, probably more on the miserly side, but not by design, just by, like, laziness. I don't think to do it. If something really makes me fucking laugh, I will retweet it.
That's your, like, retweet policy. You got to laugh
out
loud.
My retweet policy is, fuck, I wish I would have thought of that.
Yeah.
Like, damn it, that's a really great joke. I wish I would have thought of that. Yep.
Fun.
Couple
more.
Yeah.
Following policy?
If you tweet jokes, like, that's it. If you have, like, a billion tweets, like, if you tweet, like, every fucking 20 minutes or so, sorry, I'm not going to follow you.
Uh-huh.
I don't want that to fill up my feed. And, yeah, if you just have, basically, if it's interesting, you know,
gotcha.
If it has, like, a unique angle or take, as opposed to just, like, sort of spouting out jokes.
When a big thing goes down, do you feel compelled to go write a tweet about it?
Yes.
Now, what if it's, like, a real dark, sad thing, like Boston bombing?
That's interesting because we actually had that issue on Update this
year.
Oh, that's
right. You do this for a living.
Yeah,
there's a way more interesting context to ask this about.
This is all I'm curious about. I don't care about the
Update. Well, actually, the Boston bombing happened in a week we were off on SNL this year, but we came back the next week. The bombing happened, and then they found the guy by the next Saturday. So we were off. I think we may have been off for 2 weeks. But there was a bunch of stuff in the news about, like, his roommates.
Yeah.
Who, like, hit a backpack or something like that. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's like that for in deep tragedy, I think, like, it's okay to take, like, a tangential issue. And that's, like, sort of what we did at Update, is just sort of to take, like, those B stories. Like, hey, this, what about, like, the.
His stoner roommate from Dartmouth.
His stoner roommate from Dartmouth is easier to joke about than, like, the dudes themselves.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's in general what it is. But, like, I don't know, a lot of dark stuff doesn't happen. And when it does, it's like I'm not feeling rushed to. If other people are talking about it, I like to give my own take just to sort of challenge myself to, like, oh, well, a million people are blasting jokes right now. Can I get one that sort of cuts against, you know?
Or did you write one about, like, Kanye's baby?
Yeah. Kanye's baby was born. And my joke was something along the lines of, right now, somebody in Kanye's entourage is out buying myrrh.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's good.
Pretty happy with that one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you got on Twitter, you're writing, you're pumping out jokes on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the progression from there to a Weekend Update? Were people noticing you on Twitter?
Yeah,
or?
I started to get more followers, and then Christine Nangle, who actually she did in 2011 because she was still working at Saturday Night Live. She's whose place I took on The Bishop, and she was also on my first indie team,
mm-hmm. Dog Basket,
alongside Jubin Parang. Mm-hmm. And so she recommended that I submit for a job at Weekend Update. I did. It wasn't that great. I didn't do a great job of it. I was still sort of new at the skill of writing jokes and being concise and clear. Mm-hmm. So I didn't get it then. But then I got asked again the next year by Alex Bays, who's my boss and head writer of Weekend Update. Mm-hmm. Asked again, and then did a couple rounds of submissions on just writing straight up topical jokes, topical joke after topical joke. And then got the job last September, mm-hmm. or August, I guess.
I don't know why I'm unable to ask questions, right? It's like
you're rusty.
Everything's stumbling out of my
mouth. We haven't been here in a while.
Yeah.
You're literally looking at a notebook that has nothing written down.
That's right.
Except for 150?
That's the time we started.
Okay, great.
This notebook is, I don't come in with questions. I use this notebook in case I think of things I want to ask you.
Okay.
Don't pull back the curtain on this podcast.
All right. Sorry. The notebook's blank.
You haven't commented how I'm naked. How does that apply to my questioning style?
I was trying to ignore that aspect mm-hmm. of it.
But he's standing right next to you.
Yeah. Because, you started off with Devious Maids. and I figured by then it's like, people are just being normal with Will being naked, so I better go along to get along.
I ask this question of people a lot on here, but like, how do you, with these kinds of jobs, this kind of work, but how does what you learned at UCB get utilized by you in your job?
Oh, sure. I've been thinking a lot about this because I've done some monologue joke workshops here at UCB, normally mm-hmm. on holiday weekends.
That's right.
I think I've done like three or four.
You've done three.
Three? Thanks, mm-hmm. Will. Mm-hmm. How many classes have I taught?
I don't know.
Okay. All right. So how do you know I've done three?
Because we haven't done that many of them and we schedule them special.
Yeah.
I mean, like, because like the one-off workshops are not like regular things, okay. So Eric and I have to talk about them.
I assume that nobody's noticing.
No, my job is to run the school.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I've done three of these. So I have been thinking about this, and I think what it is, it's basically just like it's a lot of the just game theory, and basically if then what else? Mm-hmm. Because for monologue jokes, they take a number of forms. If it's like a topical story, it's just about identifying the game of somebody that's in the news. Mm-hmm. Kim Jong-un's sort of crazy and a little bit chubby. Mm-hmm. Dennis Rodman is nosy, like sticking his nose into North Korea stuff. Mm. Mitt Romney was a rich, aloof guy. Barack Obama's a cool guy.
Yeah.
Like has secret drones and microphones on everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's just identifying the game of that, and then the punchline normally serves or exists in the universe of that game. And then for like a man in Florida type joke of, you know, doofus in Tallahassee does doofus thing and gets his dick bitten off by a turtle or whatever it is. You know?
Yeah.
That's basically just like – that's basically giving a premise, and then the punchline is going to be the first like, oh, well, if that's true, then what else is true? The example I use in the workshops for the Kim Jong-un one or for the topical joke one, it's like, okay, well, Kim Jong-un's like a little bit chubby, right?
Right.
The leader of North Korea. It's like, hey, it's not the best joke, but we'll take it.
Right.
A joke I wrote was somewhere along the lines of Dennis Rodman told President Obama this week that all Kim Jong-un wants is an official diplomatic telephone call. Added Kim, oh, and pie. He wants two things. He wants a phone call, and he wants pie. That's his game. And then for the man in Florida type stories, there was a wedding brawl in Philadelphia, and the joke was, like the setup establishes a premise, and then the punchline establishes, oh, well, if this is true, then what else is true? So the joke that I wrote, and I think this one got on the air, was police in Philadelphia stopped a fight between two wedding parties by arresting over 500 people. Please calm the brawlers by encouraging everybody to shout a little bit softer now. It's like if the premise is wedding fight, if that's true, then the police, it's a move in an improv scene. If you had an improv scene that was a wedding fight,
right.
Or wedding brawl, you know, that's what would happen. They would shoot garters at each other. They would suffocate each other by shoving cake down their faces, the police would do.
And the real skill there is to be able to distill,
the men hide in the bathroom by saying it's time to get all the single men on the floor and then go into the bathrooms and find all the shy people.
Yeah.
Wait,
doesn't that happen during weddings?
Well, I mean, you can. Are you saying that when they...
Throughout my life, whenever they're like, get all the single men on the floor, I'm out, I'm not in the reception.
Do you know what happens when they do that?
No.
The groom takes off the bride's garter.
Uh-huh.
And then sort of like rubber bands it out into... And it's basically like the reverse of a bouquet.
Right, not in the room for that.
You're not in the room for the bouquet toss?
None of that. I avoid most of the reception.
Why do you even go?
Yeah.
Obligation. Just to get on the video and be like, have a great marriage.
Right.
When I'm sitting at the table, then I get out. Just plausible deniability.
You should just green screen that. You should just like...
Once I have the technology, I'm not even going to go anymore. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, send a hologram.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the skill there is to be able to hone in on like wedding fight, to be able to like distill that information that, you know, there was a brawl, a wedding brawl in Philadelphia, and be able to like identify that the game of that is wedding fight. I think that ability is something that separates people, you know?
Yeah. No, well, I think it's like we were talking about the pattern game. I think it's that skill in the pattern game is to take a couple disparate elements, tie them up into one thing that we can then use as a jumping off point when we start our scenes. Because, you know, in pattern games, we're going to have pretty premise heavy, or ideally, I think. The Herald team I was on Ragnarok, we did a pattern game for, I think, like my first 7 or 8 months on there. And I think we were really good at it. I thought
Ragnarok was good at it.
I think we got really strong, clear premises that were very, it was so easy to initiate after a pattern game we did. And it is just because, like, you know, we get out there and we sort of have a couple disparate ideas and we tag them. We say what it is. That's not going to kill it. You know, we're not going to, like, lose all of our steam in our scenes if we label what the game is.
No, I think that's what the idea of the pattern game is. You want to label what that is so that you can initiate with it.
Yeah.
Right, Will?
Yes. Yep. You're trying to make premises, definitely.
Well, going back to the one, what was it, diseases, like positive marketing for diseases?
Yeah.
So if you say, diabetes, I'm loving it. AIDS, catch the fever.
Yeah.
Cancer, ring-a-ding, answer the phone.
Yep.
Oh,
and then, but it's like, okay, so then we tag that as positive marketing for diseases, right? When we initiate off that, we have positive marketing for diseases. We don't have taglines for diseases. We don't have disease slogans. We have like the underlying ideas, so it's a little bit broader where we're putting the positive spin off everybody. So we would initiate it. I would initiate a scene off that thinking, oh, well, I don't have to come up with clever slogans like I did in that pattern game. What I have to do is just put the positive spin on every single thing during my awful, awful diagnosis.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
Thanks, guys. I feel very validated that I talked improv to you guys.
It's true. That's what we do here. So, like, what makes you, like, you just talked about initiating an improv scene off of a pattern game, but, like, what are the kinds of things that you love to do in an improv scene? Or, like, what makes you, like, joyful or giddy with, like, what kind of stuff do you like to initiate? Ooh. Or, like, what kind of things what kind of moves do you like to make? Or...
I like to be a fun inanimate object off the back line for a scene that's already happening, or just make something happen to sort of like kickstart the next move on a game. And this is what we did. Grandma's Ashes hosted the jam forever, so like I got to do that all the time. That was so fun hosting that jam because like all we did was like, oh well, what's out there? Oh, here's something that could like sort of steer it towards move number two, or steer it like, oh wait, that first thing you did was right, so I can like, you know, help out by giving you another fun thing to play around with.
Mm-hmm.
The example that comes to my mind is all right. I can talk about it. This is an okay form to talk about old improv
this
scenes.
This is probably
that
the
guys
only form to talk about old improv scenes.
Bardia. You guys know Bardia?
Yeah.
Okay. Bardia.
Bardia.
Hey.
Hey, guys.
How's it going, guys?
The best part about this is I know he will listen to this.
Oh, yeah. He's definitely psyched right now.
Yeah. There was some jam scene where Bardia was hosting a slumber party. I don't think it was initially about him, but it sort of became that he was the dad and he was being like a little too angry, and somebody labeled like, oh, ever since the war. So it's basically like PTSD slumber party hosting dad.
Yeah.
And it got to that moment where it's like, and it felt like, oh, well, they didn't know exactly where to go. So I like walked on stage. I was on the back line. So I walked on stage and was did popcorn popping. I was like, popcorn. Right. And then Barty freaked out. That was like, that's the most fun in the world to like, it's his thing. It's like, oh, I can do this fun little thing. And then, and then he'll flip out and like the game just tightens a little bit. Mm-hmm. Do you guys remember that? I mean, you guys are talking, right? You guys don't keep.
I might have been in that.
Hmm.
In that jam.
Sounds familiar, right? Mm.
Oh
in that scene.
Yeah. Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Hey, no, oh, it wouldn't surprise me. You guys were there every week.
Yeah.
The jam was... still are, yeah. Let's talk about the jam a little bit.
Sure.
Jam was, I've said it before in this podcast, and certainly in other, or maybe I think I have. Certainly in, well, the jam like was transformed the school, I think. The jam, as done by Grandma's Ashes and at the Beast, and since then, but for, done first by Grandma's Ashes, made the highest volume of students, I think, feel like they were part of the school. And simultaneously set good habits, like rewarded good habits, like created a real positive improv ethos so that students got proud of being associated with the jam and sort of representing its aesthetic in classes. I think that happened pretty quickly. And there's been a ton of jams in the history of the UCB Theater in New York. They've all been fun. They've all been good to some degree, but this was way different. I don't know what happened.
Can I punch in and say
you can, and for the rest of this conversation, you can do whatever you want.
Okay,
well, except leave.
I'm going to cut you off and talk about something completely different. Well, no,
you could do that.
No, with what you're talking about, like, oh, that ethos and like everybody was like very happy to be a part of it. I remember it was a couple months before I got put on Harold Knight. The jam was hosted by
Fwand, maybe.
Why would Adam Pally be in there?
Well, they would have grabbed him.
I think
Hot Sauce did it for a little while.
Hot Sauce. I think it was a Hot Sauce jam, maybe.
I think I might know what you're talking about. Yeah. I think I might have seen the jam that you're talking about.
Yeah, I was in a scene with Adam Pally. Maybe he just got called up.
Yeah, someone could just grab.
But Adam Pally was on like my favorite Harold team of all time is 1985, which Will Hines was on.
That's right. That's my old team. Well, he replaced me. But that's okay.
Well, I mean, so I really...
That's okay. I don't mean to distract it. Go ahead. Tell me about that jam.
Okay. Well, let me just reminisce more on the Adam Pally era of 1985.
Pally was one of my favorite improvisers, too.
Yeah, well,
like, for real. I always tried to get him on 85.
No, that team was great. And I think... When did you get put on the Stepfathers?
October 2007.
Okay. So there were only 2 months, I think, when I was here that you were on 1985 when I saw them. And then they existed for like maybe 4 or 5 months after that. Right?
Yeah, no,
five
year,
or six.
I think.
Oh, a year? Okay.
But okay.
So, like, just from the timing of me, like, my 1985 experiences with Pally. Yeah. But even when you were on there, even then,
wow,
you guys were great.
Yeah.
But I was in a jam and I was in a scene with Adam Pally, and I started off by trying to race little tiny race cars, you know, like those trigger little toy race cars.
Like they're magnetized to the track or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. And so I was like following them around with my eyes and pressing the button. And then Pally labeled them as like I was racing rabbits in our time. And then I said, oh, well, we have a tiny apartment. And it's like, well, I would race some longer distances, but we have a tiny apartment. And then we just did a very quick like 30 seconds of tiny apartment.
Yeah.
Where it's like I went to bed, opened the window, went on the balcony, had smoked a cigarette, all within like a 2 feet.
Yeah, yeah,
and then
yeah.
He did the same thing. Just like
that probably went over great, right?
Yeah, killed. Yeah, and it was like one of those moments where I was like, oh, yeah, I can do this.
So
yeah,
right.
That feels right. That feels good. So, like, flash forward to hosting the jam with Grandma's Ashes, like with what you're talking about, I did have, like, in my mind of, like, oh, well, if I can make that happen, like, for other people, like, that's awesome. And, like, I think it does all start off with just that idea of, like, what you can do and speaking towards, like, the better angels of an idea. Because it's very easy to make that jam move of tapping in and saying, like, you did this wrong.
Yeah.
Right. Because it's a perfectly human thing to do, too, because it puts us above, right? We're the smart person who knows what's going on. I do it, too.
And a lot of jokes come from a place of criticism or pointing out flaws.
Yeah, pointing out the unusual things, real fun, you know?
Yeah.
But if we tag in and do it without any idea of what we're going to do next, it comes off as just being a jerk.
Yeah.
And I know I did that a bunch of times, too, in the jam. But I like, you know, again, sort of being self-reflective, I noticed that when I would do it and sort of also, and what the jam helped me become a better player. Because if you speak to the better angels of an idea, there's normally a kernel of fun in there.
Yeah,
right?
It's a fun phrase. Is that yours?
No, I just came up with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's normally a kernel of fun in every idea, even if it's outlandish or ridiculous or negative. Even that move to tag in and say, like, Marsha, I don't know why you're putting that boat up to the dock with Twizzlers, right? Right?
That wouldn't be bad because you'd be endowing something. I think the worst is when you're making fun of them.
No, but I'm saying, like, if I saw in a scene that that move to, like, tag in and say, like, oh, well, why, Marsha, why are you tying that boat to the dock with Twizzlers, right? The kernel of that idea is, like, what I noticed was that you're tying your boat to a dock with Twizzlers instead of rope. That's a fun thing.
Yes.
The kernel of that idea is going to be like, I don't know, candy boating, right?
Yeah.
Maybe, you know?
Maybe.
Yeah, you can't drop anchor because it like fizzles away immediately. It's like a spree that just sort of dissolves immediately. With whatever ideas you want to, like, that's the kernel of the idea. And if you speak to the fun of that idea, you can probably make that same move without being as critical or as negative. So I think if we take in like the better angels of the idea is that kernel of fun, even if like oftentimes we, or I, and I see it too, make the mistake of coming in negative. But we're coming in negative, but that kernel of an idea is like, that's a shared agreed thing that we that I think is fun with what you did, even if I'm relentlessly negative in how I deliver it. So if we can stay away from being negative, like I think the jam helps out with that, and I think that's what we try to do. And I definitely got a lot better and a lot more trusting that like stuff like that would work. Like, let's just go with Candy Boat for a while.
How did you guys manage to just like stay interested in the jam? I mean, like, not to even put it, I just feel like for veteran improvisers to watch improv at all is sometimes demanding, and to go every Wednesday night for like so long, I feel like that's a ton of time.
It never felt like work. We had a great group of people that did it too. A very consistent group of people that did it. So like every time we would go, it wasn't like, oh, well, here's this blank slate of audience members who we might not know and it might be crazy and it might be like just a shit show. It was like, okay, well, at the very least, like these 30 to 35 people will be here.
Yeah.
Or some like of a pool of maybe like 40 people. And are these numbers right at all?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
It's also people in there.
There's 100 people at the jam, yeah.
Every jam there would be about 100 people. It'd be like between 80 and 100 names in the bucket, but about I'd say 20 to 30 of those names.
Regulars.
Like people I know, regulars, people would come all the time. People I know like they're fun that get it, that aren't like there to, you know, I don't know. That are there for the right reasons, to basically have fun and make each other's ideas look great.
Yeah, and I think also like just speaking from when Badman hosted the jam, there's like I don't think we did it every week, but it was like every other week or whatever it was. Like, there's this like, oh, we also get to do this together.
Yeah.
You know, like there's a fun, like when you have a team that like likes each other and likes doing this stuff, it's like, oh, well, we get to like go through this and get on stage and play with each other together, and also like make a bunch of students look good together, and also like have the occasional crazy that we can all like laugh about, you know?
There was always one thing that happened every night that was spectacular. So that made it easier. You know, if you go to, if you were talking about like, oh, well, coaches, like, because all of us teach, most of us teach, I think all of Grandma's Ashes teaches, no? I think that's true, yeah.
Yeah, Drew teaches.
Yeah. So we all teach, we all coach a bunch. So like there is that burnout rate, but like even if you're going into like a 201 or like a 101 practice group, right? Or 201, or actually 201's probably better because they're normally like people at 201 tend to be in their heads a little bit because they're a lot swimming around. So like a 201 practice group, if you go in and coach them for 2 hours, there's probably not going to be anything like that's like fucking, oh, that was really cool.
Sure, right.
Mm-hmm. The jam, I think that there was something every week that was like, that was really, really cool. Like even like a new way of doing stuff or like a fun idea or like an unexpected reaction. Like there's always something that's like, that was awesome.
Something unique about the Ashes jam, I think this is still true, so I'm just going to say the Beast Jam. Maybe this is because it's every week. It's the first ECB jam in like over 10 years that was every week.
Yeah, I think that continuity is a big factor.
Because it used to be like once a month, and then it would be frequently, not frequently, but like
and it's at the end,
preempted by shows a lot.
Yeah, and it's at the end of a jams. Night of improvisers.
Yeah.
Improv shows. I mean.
If it's when it's once a month, if you can make it, you would. If it's every week, like a lot of people, I think, just put it on their schedule. Like, yeah, that's why I do on Wednesday nights.
Yeah. You know? And I feel like my just sort of small sampling of attending that jam and previous jams was there was more active appreciation for like good improv moves, like for finding creative ways to say yes. We get like more applause in the Beast Jam, whereas part of a jam. This is true of Beast Jams and all jams. Is like crazy people don't know what they're doing. Or nervous people who just through nerves kind of do something nuts. There's a high incidence of sort of reckless improv behavior via ignorance or nervousness or just people who've never done it before.
Yeah, well, and for a lot of people who have done it a lot, it's their first time like on stage to a crowd that big.
Sure.
You know,
so,
if you're in like 401, you've done a few class shows, but like that's probably like one of the bigger audiences you played to. So there are going to be some nerves.
And so, sometimes that energy can take over and it can get to be kind of like a weird, quick, vicious cycle of just like bad tag outs or meta weirdness. But, and that happens at the Beast Jam sometimes to certain degrees. But more than like, if somebody admits that, would just do some supportive, brave move. If somebody from the back line who looked nervous came out and just sort of blindly became a reindeer in some Graham and Santa Claus scene, like, I feel like there'd be like a smattering of applause.
Yeah.
Or if somebody came out alone and was alone for a second, the second person to come out, there'd be like applause for that person. Just like a little bit. You'd hear, maybe it's just these like regulars who would do it.
Yeah.
That was different about the Beast Jam. There was some sort of like, you got points for the brave move. It was appreciated.
Yeah. I think appreciation's a really good word for it.
Yeah.
I think that it was, and still is, like, it's a very appreciative show.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
It's also,
because, like, also, you know, if we're doing our jobs on the back line as people who run the jam, I think if we appreciate the moves that are being made, like, I think that we've put ourselves in a good space. Like, if we appreciate them and honor them for what they could be, you know, I think we're doing all right.
Listen, it's also an insane level of joy from Asha's hosting it. I feel like just the dance songs, even before Sypha took over Jambassador, just Brandon Scott Jones, the way he would call names out of a bucket was somehow invigorating.
Yeah. Drew Luster!
Yeah. And, you know, and Morgan, just the whole team was like a crazy kind of up with people.
Yeah, whereas like a super up with people-y team.
Like a church group is hosting this improv jam sort of a little bit, right? There's some of that.
Yeah. Sure that, like, we got, when we stopped hosting the jam, I don't know, Sypha, who made our shirts? Kurt?
We all did.
Okay.
Kurt actually, like, physically got it done, yeah.
Okay. You guys got us matching t-shirts, but we may as well be a team that wears matching t-shirts. Like, it's like a very, like, up with people. Like, we may as well just, like, start choreographing dance routines instead of, like, just following the follower when we just sit out and get on stage and dance whilst one of us reads names ridiculously.
I feel that Nate Dern and John, you two...
Frusciante is my last name.
I couldn't remember. Thank you, God. It was not coming to me. Isn't that so strange that happened?
It is very strange.
And is John right?
Yes.
Okay.
We've been friends for over 10 years.
Yeah.
And
is that long?
Yeah.
God. Boy, that flew by.
Yeah.
When the Beast opened, I feel like there was sort of a decision to be like, oh, this will be we'll give students a lot more chances to get on stage now.
Yeah.
And there was, like, right away, there was like a stand-up night, an improv
just,
night,
like,
a storytelling
night. Like, send them downtown where they belong.
Banished.
Yeah. There was this whole suite of storytelling open mic, stand-up open mic, improv open mic stuff that kind of happened, and Improv Nerds got moved there pretty shortly after. Mm-hmm. Right, but for some reason, and those all have been, to various degrees, successful. But I remember, like, the fourth week or the fifth week of the jam, I was there for, I don't even know why, sold out, like, super filled with people. And I was like, what is this about? And psyched, like, everyone in the seat pitched forward watching it. I was like, I've never seen the student body this psyched up.
It was
all
crazy.
At once.
It was crazy. Like, we were just always taken aback and very, very happy that sort of happened. I don't, like, and again, I think it's just like there was a good, like, core group of people that would just come every week, and that, like, helped out a bunch.
I think it was all the factors. I think you guys were great. Having a weekly continuous show and a group of regulars, each of those combined to make this kind of, like, thing that didn't exist before. And I would say 6 months after the jam started, I started to see it in classes. Like, basically when those people came up to, like, level four, like, I remember when Kurt and Claire and Sarah were all in one class. They were jam regulars. I'm gonna say their last names wrong, but is it Sarah Feinstein, Kurt Gunther, and Claire Ayoub, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And maybe others, but they were all in 1-4, one of mine. They were all really great, but they came in more confident than a lot of people would have.
Hmm.
I think it was their first 401s. And it's because they'd been on stage at the Beast for months.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, basking in that kind of positive energy. And that's been true times many people. Bardia.
It's so much clearer when you have, like, Grandma's Ashes, support your move. And then when you get off stage, you're like, oh, that's how I could support someone else's move. Like, it's different than being taught in class than it happening live on stage.
Mm-hmm. That's certainly the way that everybody on Ashes would have learned, I think, from other people doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
it's cool.
You're right. Thanks.
Oh, I just got word this is the most insidery podcast we've ever done. I just got that's just
that
been
a dare?
Notified. no.
You okay? Because I could go way more.
Okay. So one aspect of your time that we didn't talk about is you were on Maud Night.
Oh, right? That's right, yeah.
You were an actor on Maud Night.
Actor on...
It was not Gramps, right?
It wasn't Gramps.
Thunderdome.
It was Thunderdome, yeah. I was an actor on Monday for, I guess, 3 or 4 months, mm-hmm. maybe? Yeah.
Yeah, how was that for you? What was that experience?
It was good. I consider myself to be a really terrible actor.
So how did you get
shitty.
To Maud, like, what led you to Maud Night then?
I was watching a Tennessee football game with Zubin Parang, and he leaned over to me, and like, Zubin, by the way, if anybody knows Zubin, he's like, is weirdly like a high-status like deal maker. Like, he comes off that way.
Yeah.
So,
like, he was like, hey, Joshua, you want to get on Maud Night? Yeah. Like, what? I guess I could do that. Yeah. Because he's like, I guess somebody left. I don't know what. I don't know who was gone.
Yeah, I forget who left and who you replaced.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But no, he was like, hey, you want to do, would you be interested in doing Maud Night as an actor? I was like, yeah, sure, I'll do that. Like, because I hadn't done that, and I figured, like, well, I'm not good at that, so if I can, I'd do it. I don't know why they would put me on, but I'd do it.
Right.
In the hopes of getting better. And then, Nate called me up like next week or 2 weeks, I guess, after Zubin had applied his political pressure.
Right.
And then, so I got put on Thunder Gulch, and I did like 4 months worth of shows. I think I did 5 shows because we also did a Halloween show, the Thunder Gulch.
Monsters Night Live
Halloween show. So I did 5 shows, I guess. And it was great. It was like, it definitely was like a good way for me to be better at acting, even though I think my baseline's still pretty low. Mm-hmm. I do my best. I just have no training in that. I really should. And like, I thought about like, oh, well, that's why I need to do more with improv. And like, that was around when we started doing the jam too. So I really started on the improv stage too, started to stretch my acting character type muscles a little bit. And then completely went the other way because I got hired to do a writing job. So yeah. Like, it's sort of like, oh, it's like sort of when you start working out some certain muscles and they start to get bigger and then you abandon it immediately.
So as somebody who has a very competitive side to them and who is always wanting to get better, how did it feel to be like challenged like that or in that, like you seem to very easily be able to say like, I'm not that great of an actor. How do you reconcile those two things? How do you reconcile that competitive side of you to this?
Well, you're competitive and you're arrogant when you're doing stuff. Mm-hmm. I think you have to be. I can't walk on an improv stage and think that I suck because then I'll suck. Mm-hmm. I can walk on an improv stage and like, prepare for my words to be twisted. I perform well. Both performance on stage, writing, whatever. If the following thing is true, when I'm doing it, I think I'm the best in the fucking world at it. I think I'm better than everybody on stage. I think I'm better than everybody that was on stage before. I think I'm better than the Anchor Herald team that's on after us. I think I'm better than weekend teams. I think I'm better than everybody when I'm on stage. Mm-hmm. I personally need that level of confidence in order to trust myself enough to do stuff the way I want to. Mm-hmm. As soon as I step off stage, I am relentlessly critical of myself. Like you say, like, oh, well, it was easy to say like, oh, well, you're not a very, like you admitted that you're not a very good actor. How's that? It's like, no, I admit that I'm not very good at everything. Like there's always a way to be more concise with initiations. There's always a way to be more clear in what your reaction is, to make that next move once we have a game more natural or more fitting to maybe where you are or what you're doing. There's always a way to be better. It's improv. It's not written. We haven't like gotten five drafts of something, we'll get better. But like once you walk off stage, if you want to get better, you better start writing draft number 2 of what you could have done differently to tweak it. Mm-hmm. Draft 3 of what you could have done differently. And then next time, maybe that'll filter in and you'll eventually get better in the long run. So that's how you square it. It's just like, I don't know what psychological profile this gives me. but I have to think you just have to be a swaggering jackass sort of to succeed. But like, that doesn't come out in like swaggering jackass play. It's like an all internal thing.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It doesn't come out as like you don't, you don't improvise as if you are somebody who thinks they're better than everybody else, but you feel that. Like, that's the attitude that you have. It doesn't come off in the presentation.
Yeah. Just a little bit of this, the necessary swagger that I personally, and I don't think that that's universally true for people, but I personally need to convince myself of that in order to be good.
And it, for anybody else that it is true of, you do it better than those people.
Yeah, fuck them. Fuck them. Well, actually, I'm not doing it right now, so like, they probably have their benefits and probably good, and I could probably improve on what I do. You know.
What's your favorite joke you've ever gotten on air? And I'm referring to the Weekend Update portion of Saturday Night Live.
Last joke of the year, Amy Poehler came out and did the did some jokes on Update in the season finale of this year. And the last joke we told this year was a joke that I'm really happy about. It might not be my favorite joke, but I'm really happy it got on air because of what it is.
Okay.
And it was Chris Christie, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, and Prince William toured the Jersey coast to view damage from Hurricane Sandy. Is the first meeting between the Prince of the House of Windsor and the Governor of the House of Pancake. I'm really happy because it's a Chris Christie fat joke that Amy Poehler read on air. That was cool. Just to, at this point in the game, to sneak in a Chris Christie fat joke underneath the goalpost is pretty sharp.
Yeah.
This week at an auction, a Liberty Head nickel sold for $5 million. Wait, hold on. I forgot what this joke is.
You'll get it.
It's a good Liberty Head nickel joke.
Liberty Head nickel. A Liberty Head nickel sold? Go deep.
Oh, yeah. Wait, hold on. I forget it. I forget the joke. But it was something along the lines of, well, it's something to do with the fact of, like, if I had a nickel for every mistake I've made. It's like Liberty Head nickel sold for $5 million. That's $1 million. Or that's like a dollar for every horrible mistake they've made or something. Oh, no, so now he's like, So now he has one nickel for every horrible mistake. The buyer has one nickel for every horrible financial mistake they've made.
Oh, yeah,
because they bought a nickel for $5
million. Oh, right.
That's
right.
It. That's the joke, guys.
Okay.
Nailed it. what's crazy, you just asked me this question, like, probably the fun jokes. Like, every joke I remember, a lot of jokes I remember, like, never made it to air. We write a ton of jokes to get, like, three or four on every week. Like, I write like 200 jokes and get three on every week. So it's like, they all in the rearview mirror just seem like this crazy, insane blur. So I just have like some examples that I use to talk about.
Do you have a routine that you write with or to?
No, I apply with what I was talking about that workshop of like, oh, well, if like identify the game or whatever the conventional wisdom is off a topical story, or just do like that if then what else. If I can label a game for like a Man in Florida type story, I will. So like that would be the rudimentary process, but it's not formalized. It's all happening in my brain as I go through and look at setups.
Mm-hmm. What's your strategy to write such a huge volume? Like, they can't all be good, right?
I have to.
Yeah.
It is my job to do that.
Yeah.
No, basically just like pound away and like be okay like writing a bunch of jokes on the same thing with different takes, you know. If it's the State of the Union address, just be prepared that week I'm going to write 40 jokes on the State of the Union address and just try to get every angle out there and try to be as concise as possible, you know, punchline lands at the end, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What's a good, like, I don't even know if you can answer this question, but you're talking about having like being able to look at every angle or have a lot of angles on it. Is there a good tip for like being able to find as many angles as possible? Like, was there something that you have done to push yourself to find more angles on jokes? Or is
instinctual? Well, with what Will was asking before about like, oh, when something big happens, do you feel like compelled to get out there and like get a joke out there? I do, because I think what that is like, oh, something big is happening. It's pretty easy to take stock of what the joke that everybody's doing is, right? It's pretty easy to get that, like, that's, oh, okay, everybody's thinking that. And then to tack differently from that, I think, is like a good way to help.
I remember like Beyonce got pregnant, like every single Twitter joke was like, she forgot to put a Nuva ring on it or something like that.
Yeah.
Like, that got said like at least, I can distinctly remember 10.
Yeah. Yeah, that's there's that herd mentality, and like they're worded differently, and they have different formulations. But I think at the heart, it's like, oh, well, the take on this is like, oh, I want to reference that Single Ladies song. So just don't do that. Write a joke that doesn't do that.
Yeah. Right.
That's one of the challenging things about Twitter is that there's so many people.
I think it's good for you though.
Yeah.
The best joke about Beyonce getting pregnant was guy Sam Gritner, who probably won't listen to this. Sasha Fierce would have aborted. pretty funny. It's pretty funny, I think.
Sam Gritner writes like 100 tweets a day.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Crazy number.
I ran into him in the subway. Whatever. He's a very nice person. Yeah. I ran into him once in the subway completely randomly and like just in passing. I was like, Sam Gritner. He's like, yep.
Kept going. Oh man, I think you two are kindred souls. Yeah. I would imagine that other people have Will Hines stories where that was the same thing. Will Hines, yep.
Oh yeah, I've heard them told to me. Yeah, you ran into me in the subway. You're a jerk to me. Yep. You really looked. You didn't want to see me. I'd be like, yeah, it's probably true. I don't know who you are, and you're staring at me. How about certain takes of jokes are like cop out takes, like the like, oh, that's time I'll never get back category of commenting on an event. Mm-hmm. Or, like, I feel like that happens a lot on Twitter.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. Yeah, and it's like...
Because it can apply to anything, so it's almost like a lazy
take. Yeah, it's so easy. It's so easy to do, and you really have to challenge yourself to not do that shit.
Yeah.
But
that's not really a joke about a thing. Like, because, like, what I like to do is think about, like, well, what's the take on this, right? And the take on that type of joke is, like, well, that's time of my life. I'm not going to get back. The take is, like, well, that's boring.
Right.
That's not a take on anything. That's an opinion about something. Mm-hmm. That's not a comedic take on something. That's like your personal opinion about thinking something's boring, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or the like, why should I care about this?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like the Chandler Bing school of comedy. Could this be any more boring? It's like, well, that's not really a joke. Like, there's nothing unique about that, or there's no particular take that you have on that.
So you guys are starting up soon, right? The next season of
Coming up last week of August is when I go back to work. I don't know when the premiere is going to be. Mm. When is this podcast coming out?
2 years.
2 years? Okay. Yeah. All right. So with our host and our musical guest. And then you guys can just like fill that in later with my voice saying,
"Make a guess now over who'll be hosting SNL in 2 years."
Yeah, just get Don Pardo to say, "LeBron James."
Anything else that you have coming up that you're excited about or working on or
nope?
I imagine it's pretty consuming.
It is. I've been this summer off has been good. Just done a little bit of writing, taught some improv classes, and done a lot more improv and been around it a little bit more. Mm-hmm. But just sort of heading back into the fire of just writing jokes constantly.
Sure.
Which is fun. It's weird because like I think.
How much time do we have?
We're at about an hour right now.
Okay, I'm going to make this more insidey.
Cool.
Before we go, let me know when we're going to wind it up. I'm going to bring this into the depths of insidiness.
Great.
Okay.
All right, when you were on Dog Basket, your indie team, what's your favorite opening to do at Under St. Mark's?
My favorite what?
If you had to do an opening at an Under St. Mark's indie show, what opening would you do?
Scene painting.
Okay, why?
Because it's not as static as a pattern game, because in St. Mark's it's a big thing. We're assuming like it's a good crowd.
Yeah, but not amazing.
Good crowd, but not amazing.
Yeah.
Pattern game is a little bit too dull.
Oh, Jesus, yes. You can do pattern game under St. Mark's.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you have a mixed bag of people who are improvisers and people who haven't seen improv.
Under what circumstances would you do a pattern game opening at under St. Mark's?
Under what circumstances?
Yeah.
If I got to choose what opening. Pattern game is my favorite opening. I think it speaks to me the most.
How's this? You're going out with Dog Basket.
Yeah.
You have to make the crowd laugh or you'll be shot.
Sure.
Do you do a pattern game opening?
No. Scene painting opening, because basically it gets those ideas out there. You still have that ability to label a game verbally and with clarity and concision.
Okay.
But you're also doing stuff and it looks cool.
Okay. Now I'm going to play a game called Either Or.
Sure.
I'm going to give you two choices of things you can do in an improv scene. Tell me which one sounds more fun.
Sure.
Like, would you rather do this or this in an improv scene?
Okay.
More speed round mentality then. Okay. Would you rather do Cajun accent or disappear in a cloud of smoke?
Cajun accent.
All right. Would you rather refer to a television show deliberately obscure just for the fun of making a really specific television show reference or mime pulling an album, a vinyl album out of a sleeve?
Obscure television reference.
Okay. Jetpack or hoverboard?
That's what I was just going to ask.
Jetpack. Hoverboard doesn't look cool because hoverboard kind of looks like you're skateboarding.
Okay. Zipline?
Zipline.
Russian accent or Latin, like Spanish?
Latin.
standing on two chairs to walk forward like a giant, or being picked up to make being made to look like you were flying?
Being picked up to made to look like you were flying. Ragnarok picked each other up a bunch. We did a lot of that.
Split screen or go into the audience and address the people on stage?
Split screen. I love split screen. It's one of my favorite things to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
Presentational group games are one of my favorite things to do.
Me too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do one in Grandma's Ashes show on Saturday. I was really happy about it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I love that shit.
Yeah.
Are you also a fan of the creating levels by like looking up? Like if you and I
space bending, yeah.
Yes.
Oh, anything that bends space, the space, any space bending or temporal bending, I love it.
Me too. I love that.
If you get in doubt as being in the gym, what are you doing?
Foot up on a locker, tie my shoe. Or foot up on a bench.
I got it. What if you're exercising? Mm. What exercise station are you at in the gym if you get in doubt that way?
Military press.
Uh-huh. Would you rather mime making a wrap at a deli or pulling a pizza out of a brick oven?
Pizza brick oven.
Really?
That's fun. You got that big paddle.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You're playing catch with your boy in an improv scene. What are you throwing?
Tennis ball.
Mm-hmm. Tennis ball.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
That's what I did with my brother. That's a personal experience one.
Mm-hmm.
You're at an amusement park in a scene. What's the name of the amusement park?
Carowinds.
You're a robber.
Carowinds, because that's a real one, but it's obscure. It's in the South. So
you're a robber with a briefcase full of money. How much money is in that briefcase?
$10 million.
Exactly?
$10 million, exactly.
In what denominations?
Hundreds.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Stacked. Unmarked.
You have to name a state in the Union and have it be a lame one. What's your choice? For the sake of the joke, it has to be a lame state.
North Dakota. my flash was North Dakota. But then I thought, well, I should probably do South Dakota because North Dakota's like... North Dakota's like too lame. Like North Dakota's like a stereotypical wanted, like, lame.
Back off a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. It's like just a B side of lameness.
You're in doubt as a woman getting ready for a date. What are you doing?
I'm putting on mascara.
What's more fun, opposite gender or opposite like age group? Playing really old or playing a woman?
Oh, really old. Really old's great because it opens up. You can use jazzies and hover rounds, which are great. It's one of my favorite things to use.
What is your feeling on playing animals?
Love it.
You're a waiter.
But there is a rule. This is a rule from Zach Phillips.
Okay.
Who, by the way, was the director or the coach of my first improv team in DC.
A lot of you Washington guys are up here now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Zach's rule about animals, which I adhere to, is animals can be in scenes and they can talk, but they can only be understood by other animals of the same species.
Hmm. Yeah,
so,
that's right.
And humans can talk in those scenes too, but they can't be understood by the animals. So only species can understand each other.
Interesting.
I think he's smart about that.
That's a good one.
Yep. Yeah. But from a human's perspective, if like two sheep are talking using English words, from the human's perspective, those are just baas and bleats.
You're a waiter. What specials are tonight?
Fettuccine Alfredo and a coconut soup.
You're an assassin and you can't use a gun and it has to be a spectacular death. What's your weapon of choice?
Piano wire.
Okay, you're in an orchestra. What instrument are you playing?
Tuba.
Second choice.
A washboard?
You have to be a percussion instrument besides a washboard.
Oh,
what do you
God. Crash. Mm-hmm.
You're a bassist in a band hitting on a woman trying to get her to come to your show tonight. What's the name of the club you're playing at?
Station. Just Station.
I have no more questions.
All right.
Great. How was that insidery?
I think that was pretty insidery.
That wasn't insidery at all. That was just like, it just felt like you guys just initiated a bunch of improv scenes.
Yeah. It was like
I think improvisers would appreciate that discussion more than most
people. Okay. Yeah.
Cognition test. Yeah.
I think if you weren't into improv, you'd be like, this is stupid.
Right.
Yeah.
Or more like, I don't see what is so interesting about that specific choice. But I feel like, you know, those are things you have to do in improv scenes all the time. Mm-hmm. And they're fun.
Thank you so much, Josh.
Thank you, John. Is it John?
Yes. Yeah.
And the last name again?
Frashante.
Fletcher?
Oh.
No.
That's what I was going to say.
I've known you for like, what, 3-4 years now?
You and I have
known each other since like 2000.
Yeah. I've done a lot since then, though. Met a lot of people.
Yeah. A lot of people. A lot of busy things.
Competing with a lot of names in my
headspace. We work together. We're coworkers.
I know.
All right. So before we go, I just want to encourage everybody listening to buy the Upright Citizens Brigade Comedy Improvisation Manual. It is out now. You can order it from our store at ucbtheater.com. Also, if you live in New York City, you can buy it at the Drama Bookshop. You can buy it at Strand. And there's some other bookshops you can buy it at.
You can come to the Training Center on 30th Street between 6th and 7th and buy it there.
You can buy it at our theater at UCB Chelsea or UCB East. You can also buy it at UCB Los Angeles if you're listening from there. It's a great book. I just finished reading it this weekend. And I feel like I became a better improviser from reading it. You know, like it pointed out things to, or it reminded me of things like, oh yeah, I should do that more.
It is like taking an improv class from the UCB while you're reading it. It's pretty, pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. It's a very well executed, concise book that sums up our philosophy and approach. So if you have not gotten it, get it and read it. Anything else?
That's all for now.
Thank you, Sypha.
Thank you.
Thank you, Keaton.
See you in 3 years. I guess we're going to do the next one of these.
3 years from now, we'll begin season three.
Mm-hmm. We'll look to see what happens on Devious Maids this week. I'm excited.
Josh, you watching?
Always.
Okay. Goodbye.
That massive prison about the